Welcome to Business Game Changers, where you'll hear expert tips on the big issues and the hottest trends to level up your business game. If you're building a career or building a business, this is Must Hear Radio. Here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today's show is all about taxes. Yay, our most favorite subject. No, seriously, we're going to be welcoming Alan Walensky to the program, who is the Assistant Tax Secretary under Bush. And he has a way of making taxes seem interesting. He will enlighten us from an insider's Washington perspective of how the tax policy works and what they use it for and the games they play. And it's just a really fascinating discussion about taxes. But before we get into that, we're going to be welcoming Aaron Frazen to the program, who is the CEO of Charlie. And Charlie is going to be soon your new best friend. And Charlie is this application that was written by a group of developers in Chicago. And it collects information on the internet and does a one-page summary for you of somebody that you're meeting with. So if you're a salesperson, a marketing person, or any kind of business development person, and you are interested in developing trust and building a relationship with somebody, Charlie is a very useful little program. And on top of it, it's free. So it's something that you're going to want to hear about. So let's first welcome Aaron Frazen to the program. Hi, Aaron. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, Sarah. How's it going?
It's going great. You know, I wanted to have you on because you have this application called Charlie, and I think Charlie could be everyone's best friend, and maybe that's why you guys called it Charlie. I don't know. But
yeah, we definitely called it Charlie to be your assistant or best friend, whatever you need.
Well, I could see this being my best friend. Well, the reason why I found you is I always look around for things, and MIT has you listed as one of the smartest companies this year, and I'm like, okay, well, what is this? And so I dug into it, and I thought, this is really neat. And can you just give us a brief overview about what Charlie does? Because it's pretty cool.
Yeah, so Charlie is an app for professionals. And minutes before any meeting you walk into, Charlie sees who you're about to meet with and researches them and their company and then sends you a one-pager on everything you need to know. So it's basically your executive assistant to brief you before you walk into any big meeting. And we have about 25,000 users on Charlie who have connected their calendar, and every single day they can walk into every single meeting prepared with intel on the people they meet with.
So this is an extremely useful little deal for you, for any professional that wants to be prepared for a meeting. What kinds of things do you track, or do you, it's not even tracking, it's retrieving, right, off of the internet?
Yeah, our whole goal is to do what you would do already, but for you, so that you can spend your time actually in conversations and actually, you know, working. And so we just want to eliminate all the Googling, all the time you spend doing that research. So we'll go through all the major social networks. We go through 150,000 news sources every day. And then we package that all up into a one-pager that we email to you minutes before the meeting.
Oh, wow. So it looks at their calendar and mails it. What happens if you want it sooner than that?
What happens if you want it sooner than that? You
yeah.
can go. We basically have an agenda on our website where you can see your next week's worth of research. So once you create an account at charlieapp.com, you can just check out your agenda, and maybe you have a big meeting a week from now, you can just navigate to that. And you'll see everything from what are the social network profiles of the person you're meeting to what are the things that they're passionate about and people you know in common to any articles they've been in, so you can congratulate them on it. Just anything that you might need to know to either break the ice, build trust, or a lot of salespeople use this, so anything that you can use to learn more about their company.
Well, this would be a salesperson or a marketing person's dream application. I mean, I could just see it. And even for me, as a radio host for that purpose of finding people and learning about them, I think that would be really useful. So what have people been finding as the most useful with it?
I think a few things. Most people come to Charlie App to automate the research they were doing themselves. And pretty quickly we spread throughout different organizations. So Salesforce.com uses it. And when we asked their sales reps why, it was because, you know, their strength is going in and talking with people, but it's not necessarily Googling and figuring out all this information. They find that to be something that takes them a lot of time. So just the automation aspect and the part about it that we're always ready for you. You could be having back-to-back-to-back meetings and just rushing from one place to another, but you'll always know that our research will be ready in your email before the meeting once you sign up at charlieapp.com.
Wow. Okay. So you have relationships with big sales like Salesforce.com and other places so that it makes it easier for salespeople to reach your tool.
Yeah. Salespeople and executives are by far the biggest users.
Well, yeah. I mean, any business executive would be drooling over something like this. So are you venture funded?
We raised $1.75 million from Chicago VCs, the main one being White Bank. We're in Chicago and we were started here about 3 years ago.
Okay, so you're past that. Have you guys put in a lot of your own money to get it going as well, and then you brought in a second round of venture funding?
Yeah, we put in some of our own money at the beginning, and then we just kind of hustle. But at the beginning of Charlie, we actually did the research ourselves. We wanted to prove that people wanted it. And so we told them that they can get their own research for their next three most important meetings. And what they didn't know was we were staying up until 2 or 3 in the morning on Google compiling outlines of what they needed to know. And then fast forward a couple years later, Charlie does it all automatically. So we've grown up a lot.
Well, how do you think this has changed the dynamic of how people work together?
I'm finding that today people are getting so busy and you're meeting so many more people than we ever have in history because of all new types of technology, whether it's social networks or even just, you know, planes and cars. We're now able to meet with so many more people than we ever have. And because of that, we don't get to know the people that we're meeting as much. It's all condensed down to just 30-minute, you know, coffee or 30-minute phone calls, whatever it is. And so you barely scratch the surface with the people you meet with. And our goal is to make it so that, you know, you can still meet as many people as you need to for your job, but you can actually truly connect.
And making it easier for people to connect, because a true connection is what really gets a sale to happen, right? Or a relationship to start and to be able to nurture that.
It's all about trust. We get cold calls all the time, and you know, you don't want to answer that because you feel like someone's just pushing things at you. And people,
that's
because
you're a
it's not about you, it's about the other person.
That's because you're a CEO. You're a business leader. You're going to get bombarded.
Yeah, it's crazy. I
know.
Find out how to get my phone up.
I know. That's the problem you're going to have forever now that you're the running a company. But yeah, you're right. And who wants to deal with that, right? And because you are you're in that sales kind of environment and marketing and a nice guy, I find myself, I have to be nice to those people because I'm there too. I don't want to be an a-hole. I got to be nice to them.
Yeah. I should have talked to you years ago. You could have told me that I would have received all these calls if I chose this profession. Maybe I would have reconsidered.
Oh, it only gets worse. You just got to figure it out. But sometimes if you weed out some of those, if you have somebody that weeds them out for you, they have to be good, because if you just weed out everybody, you end up losing some pretty good connections.
Yeah, and you know, people have started to actually use Charlie to call me, which I do appreciate that. They'll call me and they'll congratulate me on something, and I'll be like, how did you know? How did you know that?
Oh. You know, we were just connected. That's awesome.
As a top 5 tool and they'll be like, oh, I use Charlie, and then I'll take the call. So
well, that's great.
Hopefully this doesn't lead to many more cold calls from people, though.
Yeah, they use Charlie to find you. Well, how much, if somebody really wants to use this, how much does it cost?
Right now, Charlie is free.
Oh, my gosh.
We're laser focused on product and growth right now. Over 25,000 professionals use our app, and we're going to be releasing team tools pretty shortly where you can actually use Charlie in Salesforce.com and get deeper research so that you can be even more prepared for your call.
Oh, that's great. And then you might charge for the team tools, but Charlie's free? Is that
how team tools like Salesforce enable you to get research on people whether or not they're in your calendar. So maybe you have a list of 100 people you want to call in the next week. You could just start your day by clicking on the Charlie Research button in Salesforce and then come back after your coffee, and 10 minutes later you'll have, here's what you need to know before each call. When you make this call, here's the biggest part.
Oh, yeah.
You know, anything like that. Those are some of the big team tools that, you know, Salesforce.com and Yelp and Twitter, a lot of the sales teams that use Charlie have been asking us for.
Well, you know what's interesting, because this is a really good practical application that uses data that's out there and available for people. And this is where things are going, where the data is really used as a useful function to make life just better, to make it work better. You know, the sales, the marketing, that kind of stuff. Now, do you ever get any pushback where people just don't like all that information about them on the internet, and why are you collecting it?
We only do what you could do. So we don't go beyond that. So if your Facebook profile is private, we don't look at it. We're just trying to act as your assistant. So we don't really receive much feedback on that, because we make it so easy to look. If you want to be private, it's private. And if your social networks are open because you want to leave them open, great.
It's public information, so, right?
Yeah, it's all public information.
Okay, well that's good to know. So how do they get to your website so they can sign up for this free deal?
Yeah, so you go to charlieapp.com.
Okay.
And that's CHARLIE and then app.com. And from there, you just go to the website and you sync your calendar, and then you can just sit back, relax, and then an hour before your meeting, you can just look at your email, and from then on, you'll have research ready for you.
Oh, how fantastic. I'm going to sign myself up for that. Especially since it's free, I got to check it out. I'm doing it. I'm there. Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us and explaining this thing to us.
Yeah, thank you so much, Sarah. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, sounds good.
Now we are going to talk taxes with Alan Walensky, and we're going to learn the ins and outs about our tax system from a Washington insider. Hi, Alan. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Sarah. How are you?
I'm doing great. All except that tax season is right upon us, and I don't think anybody likes tax season, huh?
Well, let me ask you an important question.
Yes.
Have you filed your taxes?
We have. But that's because my son's going to school in the fall, and we had to do it. So normally we file extensions, but this year we kind of had to.
Probably also means you're getting a refund.
No.
Oh.
It means we had to see, you know, the whole college deal. But we got a tax, almost a $10,000 tax credit for doing solar this year. So I wasn't as painful as normal.
Well, that's good.
Yes.
Good. You're ahead of some of the rest of us.
Yeah, but I'm not usually. This is very odd for me.
Well, good. Good.
Well,
keep up the good work.
Yeah.
The government needs the money.
Yeah, keep up the good work. Well, it's not going to happen much longer. Okay, well, let's dive into this. There was a huge tax increase starting January 1st, 2014, and I'm going to just give you examples. The top income tax, you probably know all this, but the top income tax bracket went from 35% to 39.6%. The top income payroll tax went from 37.4% to 52.2%. Capital gains went from 15% to 28%. And dividend tax went from 15% to 39.6%. So what do you think that's going to have as an effect on the economy?
None.
None at all? Why?
I think that there's something that's called the Laffer Curve, and named after an economist who became famous at a young age. He's still alive in the era of Ronald Reagan. And it postulated that to a certain point, lowering of taxes actually increased government revenues. Kind of a counterintuitive idea, but the notion would be that if taxes are too oppressive, people won't work as hard as they should, people won't sell assets, and the government will generate less revenue. The question really, both academically and practically, is where is the point at the Laffer curve where increasing taxes decreases revenue, or conversely, lowering taxes stops increasing revenue? In other words, what's the optimal point? And I think the optimal point is not an exact point, but it is really a range. And I may be taking a little more time on this subject.
No, this is good. What is that?
Then you may like, and let me put in
that's a future
historical.
That was a question I was going to ask you, is where is that range? Because I know if you charge too much, people will figure out how to get around it. If you charge too little, you're just not getting I'm not sure if the goal of government is to maximize the taxes. Now, that's a different subject.
I'd say there are two main, let's go down to basics. I would postulate, I think many academics would, that there are two basic functions a tax system ought to serve. One is you need to raise enough revenue, whatever that number is, to allow a government to function. The other is that a tax system should be or should be perceived as, quote, fair, close quote, whatever that means, and we can get into that in more detail. But I'd like to provide a little bit more historical perspective, particularly as the number of us who remember much, much higher tax rates diminishes as people of my generation and older start to die off.
Well, it used to be in
the 90s. At the risk of being morbid, but after all, the only two certainties in life are death and taxes. So ultimately, it is a morbid subject.
Well, but it used to be in the 90 percentile, right?
Very good. Very good. Yes. Actually, in as recently as the early 60s, the maximum marginal rate was 90%. Let's just think about that. That means if you're at a certain tax bracket, for an extra $1 million you make, the government gets $900,000. The federal government, not even counting state, you only get $100,000. That's not much of an incentive to wake up in the morning and at 5 a.m. and go start performing heart surgery at 7:30. So that clearly was a system that was overburdensome.
Well, but then people figured out how to do other things. They paid themselves
sheltered.
Through.
They sheltered.
They sheltered. They paid themselves through the company. Next thing you know, everybody's buying their house through the company or whatever. They just did whatever they could to get around it.
Yes. No. Very good. You're absolutely right. The difference is that the super wealthy, the richest people in the country, owned a lot of real estate or used other methods to shelter much of their income. So many people were not paying that rate. But the rates were high nonetheless. And then I remember it was considered sort of a major breakthrough when the maximum rate was reduced to 70%. Still, by any modern standard, an extraordinarily high rate. Actually, in the early 60s, John Kennedy, with the assistance of a now deceased but in his day very famous economist from the University of Minnesota, Walter Heller from the University of Minnesota, was the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, the team that advises the president on economics policy. And they did the then innovative and historic step of cutting taxes to stimulate the economy. And it worked. It did. And since that time, tax cuts have frequently been used to stimulate the economy. But that really only occurred as recently as the early 1960s, and again under the auspices of a very famous longtime local economist, and that was viewed as innovative. So as we moved through the 60s, eventually the rate got down to, the individual rate got down to 50%, and that was viewed as a very positive step. At least you could keep half of what you make. Now, going back to the Laffer curve, and at
yeah,
what
where
point,
is that optimal rate? That
the short answer is it depends on individuals. I think it's a range. I would say the range is somewhere between 40% and 50%. I mean, if you actually, if you look at the people who make the most money as a group in this country, it would be the Wall Street hedge fund managers. Between New York state taxes, New York City taxes, and federal taxes, their combined rates are certainly at 50%. And I think most of the hedge fund managers are showing up for work every day and not afraid to make that extra $100 million or $500 million or whatever.
Not afraid. I wouldn't be too afraid to make my extra $500 million either.
Even if the government took half, right? You'd
yes.
be willing to share.
Well, I don't know if I would like sharing.
Well,
but if you, I was you, making $500 million, I wouldn't be too upset about it. No.
You wouldn't stay at home and necessarily call.
But you don't think doubling the capital gains tax, essentially 15 to 28,
well,
or almost tripling the dividend tax, is not going to hurt our economy?
Well, let's go back to each of those, because I think they each are significant, and I think they each bear significant analysis. The capital gain tax is one where, you know, Harry Truman in the old days when he was getting economic advice as president used to say he always wanted a one-handed economist because he got sick of the economist saying on the one hand, but on the other hand. He could never get a straight answer. And I think the capital gain tax, I could get six Harvard or MIT PhD economists who say that lowering the capital gains rate will stimulate investment, and six people with similar degrees who will say it won't. My own personal observation of 40 years in the law and business world is I think that lower capital gains rates do encourage investments. And I think particularly at the margin when you're looking at speculative investments such as venture capital, which are vital to start new businesses and to encourage jobs. I do think we are getting close to the level where certainly if the capital gain rates get any higher, I would have concern that could be a detriment to incremental investment. The dividend tax is most interesting because it's kind of a double whammy in that just as we're reaching this baby boomer bulge, where if you've paid by the rules, you've hopefully built up a nest egg, to now suddenly tax dividends at a higher rate, really to me, as a baby boomer, seems to be unfair. I don't know that it's going to materially affect people's appetite for stocks. You know, to what extent do people buy for yield? To what extent do they buy for long-term capital appreciation? But I view that as a stealth tax, if you will, when enacted, something that wasn't discussed. And it goes to a little broader theory as we talk about potential tax.
What do you
reform.
Mean? Can I stop you for a second? What do you mean it
sure.
wasn't discussed?
Well, it just kind of
happened.
It just kind of happened.
How does that happen?
Well, that's, I think, gets us into a very interesting realm, which is what I'm going to call the tax legislative process.
Because, if there's one thing that makes me mad the most is when taxes just happen and it's not. You have the biggest.
It's not openly discussed. There's not a consensus that's built up. It just pops in out of the blue.
Yeah, and the dividend tax really feels like it's affecting the average Joe worker who has pension funds and they're investing in safe companies, and it's a way to get money from the middle class.
Yes, and let's. I want to talk a little bit if it's okay, about the tax legislative process. And I want to go back to something that George W. Bush did in his first tax bill. And that is, there are a number of countries that tax the income earned by a corporation or a business entity only once. Most European countries do that. In other words, what they do is dividends that are passed through to shareholders essentially are untaxed. So you can look at money earned by a corporation. It's taxed at the corporate level in the United States, and then the dividend is again taxed to the shareholder, i.e. double taxation. And economists have questioned the efficiency of that. One of the things that George W. Bush did was he cut the dividend tax to make it equal to the capital gain tax, which he also lowered, which at that point was at 15%. I thought it was a very innovative step and something that did not receive the attention or praise that I think that it was due.
Well, by double taxing the dividend tax, essentially is what you're saying, that's what? What's double tax on 39%? It's getting up there to 70%.
Yes, and what's also interesting and makes this a little bit more complicated is that most private businesses have converted from what are called C corporations, corporations that are taxed under subchapter C of the Internal Revenue Code, to limited liability companies, which are taxed like a partnership, in which the tax consequences of the entity flow directly through to the shareholder. So let's say that you and I own a $1 billion private company, and we are a limited liability company. The corporation is not taxed. The tax consequences flow through directly to us as a shareholder. So if the company makes $100 million and we're 50-50, you pay tax on $50 million, I pay tax on $50 million, but you don't get that second tax that would have adhered to a dividend. Limited liabilities started to become creatures of state law in the early 90s. Minnesota was actually one of the leading states, the third or fourth that adopted one, and now virtually every state has a statute, and almost every privately owned business is a limited liability company and therefore taxed only once. So, but I want to go back to the tax legislative process if we can.
Yeah, go ahead. Explain how that happens, because it just doesn't make sense that, you know, how that slides by, because that's an enormous percentage. That's an enormous amount of money that they're taking.
Well, here's the taxing process is so political and so controversial that a number of these measures are consciously conceived as stealth measures introduced only at the last minute to prevent lobbyists from coming in and talking Congress out of it.
Yeah, because this would have been hyper. They would have gotten all over this.
And let me maybe walk through the tax legislative process a little, because it may help give the audience some sense of why the law is as complicated and crazy as it appears. And the initial culprit, of course, is Congress. The laws are complicated because that's the way Congress has them written. And they don't sit there with the idea of let's make it as complicated as possible. Sometimes they do when they want to hide things. But it comes as a measure of what I'd call fine-tuning or efforts to have to micromanage fairness. So there is a professional tax staff. The tax writing is done by on the Senate side by the Finance Committee, on the House side by the Ways and Means Committee. They each have their own technical professional staffs of tax lawyers and accountants. They also have a combined committee known as the Joint Committee, which is substantially larger than their own staffs, and they basically go about writing the tax laws. So one of the elements that for most of the last 50 years has been in force is something that's known by the acronym PAYGO, meaning you have to pay as you go. So if I'm going to give you a tax benefit worth $2 billion, I have to raise another $2 billion from some other taxpayer
to balance it out.
And
situation, if they increase the dividend tax from 15% to 39.6%, they conversely reduce the tax rate somewhere else. It's not obvious.
Yes, unless they're actually consciously trying to raise revenue.
They are trying to consciously raise revenue, I would assume.
Yes, in an effort to deal with the deficit. But let's go back to that concept of PAYGO for a minute, because that makes for its own Alice in Wonderland world. Because all of a sudden, as you start to think about it, let's say I want to go in there and get $1 billion farm subsidy. I go to my friends on Finance or Ways and Means, who I've tried to cultivate relationships with, perhaps with large campaign contributions. And then they're going to say to me, well, first of all, you're going to have to come up with an estimate of what it's going to cost. And secondly, you're going to have to make some suggestions for how to pay for it. So you get into something called the process of revenue estimating. Economists who sit in offices with green eye shades and little pencils and computers and try to guesstimate what the tax consequences of a particular tax measure would be. So if I'm going in and looking for a tax subsidy, I want to get a good revenue estimate, i.e. low, $500 million instead of $1 billion. So I only need to come up with a revenue raiser of $500 million. And so you have a whole cottage industry of economists who used to work on the government side who now do revenue estimates for private taxpayers seeking special tax legislation. So part of the lobbying effort is to have your economists convince the government's economists that the revenue estimate is going to be low, where you're getting the benefit, and high, where you're coming up with a revenue raiser. Let me mention one other thing that once it's mentioned, people will notice from time to time in reading the business section. In the world of revenue estimating, which has become an important part of the legislative process, I mean, it's really crazy that a handful of economists drive tax legislation at different points in time, but there is a concept, the buzzword is dynamic revenue scoring.
Do you think, before we get into that, do you think, because you just said that economists pretty much run the world out there.
Not wrong, but have a substantial influence that is probably disproportionate to what it ought to be.
But do you think that's because the congressmen really don't quite understand the big picture when it comes to the economy, and so they just rely on their...
No. I think it was an effort to insert some discipline into the process, which instead of being a total orgy, it becomes, instead of taking the punch bowl away at midnight, they take it away at 10 p.m. So
it puts a little bit of constraint on what they're doing.
Yes.
Okay.
And forces them to think it through more. And depending on the subject, some things are more predictable than others.
That's actually good, though. I get them to force them to think it through.
Yes. Okay. Jackie Mason once said the only way you could ever balance the budget was to put Congress on a commission. And this is kind of a way of...
Yeah, tie them to the... Yeah, exactly.
Right. Give them some stake in the outcome. But just for the audience, there's a term that gets thrown around when tax legislation is being considered, and that's called dynamic revenue scoring. What does that mean? Dynamic revenue scoring. That means, and it's typically advocated by conservatives who think lower taxes are beneficial always for the economy, and that is when they look, for example, at, let's say, increasing the investment credit. they would say you can't just take into account what the addition of one additional machine at a factory will have, but you need to be more dynamic about it, because you buy more machinery from Machine Company, Inc. Machine Company, Inc. then takes the money and they hire more people. Those people get paid wages, and then those wages in turn increase demand at the grocery store, at
So your investment of a dollar turns into multiple dollars worth of
It would basically apply a multiplier, if you will, to various measures as you try to estimate how much income they'll generate. By the way, let me tell you another game that is really bizarre that can at times have a hugely disproportionate interest on the process. And that is the period of time over which you measure PAYGO, whether a tax bill is tax neutral. It used to traditionally be 5 years. How much do you lose? How much do you gain over 5 years? Now it sometimes gets stretched out to 7 or 10 years. But you will see provisions where people game the system, where for the first 5 years, if you're looking to reduce a tax subsidy, you might have minimal numbers during the first 5 years. And then, you know, years 5 through 10, the subsidy, under the terms it's written, might really jump. So you get your adverse impact outside the window that you're measuring it. So, you know, it's the old story about statistics. Figures
exactly.
Don't lie, but liars can figure. So as in many, many things economically, whether it's Wall Street or the federal budget or any business, the devil is in the details and statements, read the footnotes.
So they basically make it so that they'll increase one thing or decrease it, but so that the adverse effects happens when they're out of office or when it's less painful to them?
Yes. Yes, and or for purposes of the measuring system that...
Or people have forgotten or something where they get used to it. Okay, let's give them 5 years to get used to it, and then we can do something else.
Yes, and actually, there has been a sideshow in the tax law involving some of America's biggest, most profitable, most successful companies. Another buzzword I'm going to use are tax extenders. There was a research and development tax credit of 25% that about 35 or 40 years ago was put into the code on a, I can't remember, it was a 2 or 3 year basis. That thing has been extended ad hoc ever since that time. And there's always this.
But that's our problem.
Yeah, exactly. There's always an 11th hour struggle. Do the extenders get extended or not? And it's just not good business because companies can't rely on it.
They can't rely on it, and then you have to go back, change taxes. It's all, and that's the problem with how we manage the government in the first place. When you're a corporation and your taxes is our funding, right? It's the government's funding. When you're running a corporation, you're not messing around. I mean, you have a budget, you do what you can, you try to be the most profitable, and you go forward. Now, the government, I don't think, should be in the business of trying to be the most profitable. I think that's the goal is wrong. But they should still manage it the same way as a company does.
Yes, and they've tried to impart more discipline through this PAYGO approach, but What's really happened is that, of course, when we went through the deep recession of 2008, it was Katie bar the doors, and even a conservative president like George W. Bush said, "Hey, we've got to do whatever it takes to get the country out of this." And so we've walked out of this with an unprecedented amount of debt. And with interest rates that essentially net of inflation are zero. So, of course, the $64,000 question is, when will interest rates go up? It appears sometime relatively soon, and what will be the impact of that on the economy? And
yeah, that's a big question, because raising interest rates is going, people just aren't used to it, and now you're it's going to be interesting.
Well, it is, and remember, there's also a hidden cost of raising interest, which is it not only affects everybody who borrows money.
Causes inflation.
Well, besides that, the largest borrower, of course, is the U.S. government with $16 trillion of debt. So, look what it does to the national budget if interest rates were to revert to, let's say, more normal levels, more historic levels of 5 or 6%.
Yeah, they're in a catch-22. They don't know what to do with that. They really
don't. They don't know what to do because
that's why it's sitting
all of a sudden a larger and larger portion of the budget will consist of interest, and between Social Security, medical care, and interest on the national debt, we won't be able to buy as many missiles.
Which is where the money should be going, right? Okay, I have a question for you. As a tax secretary, Terry, how do you get involved in the process when it comes to legislation?
Good question. And how I got involved and how people are now involved has changed over time. For many years, let's call it the pre-1992, say from the 60s to the early 1990s. It was a relatively closed and very professionalized process. The head staff person on the Joint Tax Committee of Congress, the professional tax writing staff, a man named Lawrence Woodworth, he had been in there forever. You had a chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, Wilbur Mills, and a chairman of the Finance Committee, Russell Long, who also had been there forever, were very smart and highly professional, and essentially the three of them plus the administration could broker tax legislation.
And then Congress would just vote on it and it would go through?
Yes.
It was an easy pass-through? Okay.
Yes, pretty much. And I don't know if you remember what happened to Wilbur Mills, but in, many, many scandals ago, but in its day, certainly the scandal of the year, Wilbur Mills, who really was a very smart man from Arkansas, and they claim one of the reasons he was so smart is that he went home every night and read the tax code.
Which sounds so much fun.
It helps sleep. He didn't have to take sleeping pills.
Exactly.
But apparently Wilbur, at least on some nights, was doing other things. And he ended up one night at a little too much slicker in the Tidal Basin in Washington, D.C., if you know where that is, near the Jefferson Memorial.
Yeah.
So he literally put his car into the water. And Wilbur was not by himself. He was with a legendary Washington stripper by the name of Fan Fox, whose nickname on the billboards of the strip club were the Argentinian Firecracker.
Oh, that's great. And so then what happened?
Yeah. Well, Wilbur lost his chairmanship. And
he just got caught doing it publicly and in a really dumb way.
Yeah,
because I'm sure
it's kind of like that driver who wants to be the last person to drive on Lake Minnetonka before the ice goes out. It's just never a good idea unless you have one of those amphibious vehicles that goes on land and water, like Lyndon Johnson. It's a bad idea to drive your car into a body of water, whether it's a river or a lake. So that was a great fodder for the Washington Press for a long period of time. But I will tell you, the first time I went to a tax hearing as a lawyer right out of law school in 1976, and Wilbur Mills was holding court, and the thing went back and forth, and then, boom, he hit his gavel, and that was the end. So I looked to the person next to me. And I said, what did they just decide? What's happened here? He said, well, Wilbur will go back to his chambers, and Larry Woodworth, the staff person, will they'll have a couple of bourbons, and they'll decide the way the tax law is going to be.
And people were okay with that?
And people were okay with that.
Why?
Well, I think the system worked, and you just had a different Congress with a very, very strong committee system, and that was the process. And
they let committees decide on their own, and they didn't get involved in all the other committees.
Yes.
And, okay.
Yes, and by the way, under House rules, once a tax bill was reported out, you voted up or down, you can't make changes. The Senate's different. So, and still today, the Senate has, each individual senator actually has some influence over tax legislation because all Senate bills are openly debated on the Senate floor. But back to the administration. The administration really professionalized its input into the tax legislative process in the 1960s with a famous tax law professor at Harvard by the name of Stanley Suri, who did a couple of innovative things. Number one, he wanted to bring down the best and the brightest, although some of those people were involved with Vietnam, and we saw what they did for the country in that regard. Maybe if you analyze it, they did the same thing in tax. But he introduced or popularized a concept in the tax law called tax expenditures. So he said, really, the right way to look at these tax subsidies is to treat them as though they were a direct subsidy by the legislature. So if you're giving low-income housing credits and the revenue cost is $1 billion, that's really no different from doing a billion-dollar, passing $1 billion low-income tax subsidy. So you may say, well, what difference does it make, or why does it come in through the tax system? And the answer is, and this goes to a flaw I was talking about earlier, it's easier to hide things in the tax code. So if you come out for low-income housing and you say we need another $20 billion for low-income housing, and you introduce it as a spending bill,
people won't do it.
People won't do it, but if it's hidden in the form of tax credits, they will. So what we've really done is we've asked the tax code to bear a lot of weight for social programs.
That's a really good point that I don't think people realize, is that's where a lot of the spending occurs.
Yes.
Tax credits.
Yeah. Yes, that's where a lot of the bodies are buried. In fact, let's take it a step forward and go to this deep recession that we just went through. We attacked that recession almost exclusively via tax policy, lowering of taxes, as opposed to fiscal policy of spending more money. Now, Obama did have a plan. But remember, we had the controversy over why is there so much green in there? Why aren't there more shovel-ready jobs? You could argue that a way to put more people in jobs faster would have been to have some type of a modern WPA, as we used in the Depression, to put people directly to work. But actually, we took the tax code and interest rates, basically taking interest rates to zero.
Well, how much do you think that with these huge tax increases, do you think that's just a way to get more revenue? Instead of increasing pet projects, you increase the taxes, and then they have all this extra space to be able to do all their pet projects through credits.
Well, actually, the federal budget is really pinched, because the room to maneuver has become very small. And
but even if you do a huge increases, you think it would be?
Well, I don't think a huge increase is in the cards.
Well, you don't think a dividend tax that almost triples isn't a huge increase?
Well, but I think right now with a Republican Congress, I don't think big tax increases are they're just not going to happen. And
do you think they'll roll that back?
No, because I think it would be vetoed. But I think we're sort of at a standstill where taxes by historic measures, by those, you know, 90, 70, 50% things, are still relatively low. And now you've really got the question of progressivity. Is the tax code fair when you have the country increasingly becoming divided, you know, the 99.1 or the 1% or the 0.1%? Has such a disproportionate amount of the country's assets and income. So we're really, I think, in very uncharted waters, and we're really in a very difficult box. So just let's talk maybe about the budget a little bit, because we're sitting here with, in round numbers, $16 trillion deficit, unprecedented. We're sitting here with zero interest rates, essentially, that are about to go up, and we don't know the impact that will have on business. And we are, there are certain things that have been built into the budget that are difficult, if not impossible, to contain. And let's talk about them.
Well, and I want to, you know, we have military, healthcare, and education. And healthcare
right.
being the big one, but military is off. How far off the charts is military compared to healthcare?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. Healthcare right now is roughly Medicare and Medicaid is roughly 23% of the federal budget.
How much is education?
Well, I haven't seen education break out, but it's a lot less.
And then military.
Military is about 20%.
Okay, so it's about what healthcare is. Is there what's how much is debt payment?
Debt payment now is about 8%. But you know, if interest rates go up a little bit, boom, all of a sudden the 8% becomes 16%. And then where are you going to cut?
Well, it could go up just a little bit, and it could go. I mean, if it goes up to 3%, that could be worse than because they're not paying it down. They're not paying anything on it really right now. So, how much is the black budget?
How much is the what?
The black budget, all the dark projects that aren't known about.
Well, by definition, we don't know. I mean that because they're black. But I mean that. I mean,
but
for example,
it's part of the budget, right?
Yes, and we don't know how much gets hidden in there. And of course, a classic example is the Iraqi war. The president had an economic advisor who was on sabbatical from Harvard named Larry Lindsey. Larry Lindsey made the mistake in testifying. It's always dangerous when you testify because the wrong thing comes out on the front page of the Post. You lose your job. And that's what happened to Larry. He estimated that the Iraqi war could cost as much as $300 million.
Which
was
way
under. And he lost his job
for
that because the official line was it won't cost more than $100. And he was fired. Went back to Harvard. Of course, he was off by a couple of decimal points. It's probably closer to $3 trillion. And the difficulty that we found in the Iraqi war was so much of the war was fought, if you will, off budget, not through the military, but by companies such as Halliburton. And I remember
where does that show up in the budget then? If it's not through the military budget, where does it show up?
Well, it's probably hidden in parts of the military budget. In other words, it wouldn't be a direct appropriation of the Iraqi war.
Could it be hidden? Can it be hidden in healthcare and education and housing and all over the place?
I don't think so. But certainly, the CIA has a large discretionary budget.
But is CIA
only a handful of members? Only a handful of members on a select committee get to
but
see.
But is CIA and NSA considered part of the military budget?
I believe so.
Okay.
But let me go back to Halliburton for a minute. What they did in the war is a number of functions that traditionally would have been handled by the military were subcontracted out to people like Halliburton. For example, the military was essentially pared down to combat-ready troops, and that was about it. Logistics and transportation, a huge part typically of any war, was essentially contracted out. And I remember when I saw at one point they were showing casualties of the war, that Halliburton, relatively early in the war, had had over 1,000 casualties. They were really fighting half the war.
Yeah, they were the soldiers.
Yes, but they were the driving the trucks, which is among the most dangerous things you could do in Iraq. And so, by the way, there are multiple billions of dollars of cash unaccounted for that our ground soldiers took into Iraq in an effort to use to bribe local chieftains to try to win the war. And Lord only knows how much of that money is unaccounted for.
Well, I've heard that we're the trillions, multiple trillions have over the last couple decades is lost.
Yes.
And, you know, that's black budget loss. Well, I suppose it would be fraud and black budget. But what, you know, with the Federal Reserve.
By the way, just if I can interrupt, sir, just to put this in perspective.
Yeah.
50 million or less is considered a rounding error. So if you come up with a revenue loss of, 45 million or 30 million or an expenditure of 30 million, that doesn't even make it to the page. That's just a rounding error.
Yeah.
So, that's, you know, I mean, here's what happens. We sit here.
But trillions isn't a rounding error. That's not a collection of just maximizing rounding error every year. Yes.
No. But, I mean, the simple fact of the matter is, everybody in this part of the world gets up every day and they go to work, and most people put in a full day, and a bunch of money gets shipped off to Washington. And if you've been to D.C. lately and you see the wonderful subway system and the beautiful national parks and everything, and the restaurants and the shops and the luxury condos, you know that not all of the money gets sent back from where it came.
I'm sure that's true. Well, I have an interesting question to ask you. The Federal Reserve has the ability to loan money. When they did that one-time audit, they found that they loaned out $16 trillion to overseas banks and you know, flooded the whole international scene with money, which we didn't approve. Congress didn't approve, but they did it anyways because they're an independent company, as they claim, so they shouldn't be audited. But yet we are responsible for the money they put out there as taxpayers. So my question is, could they also be funding projects directly, black budget projects, because you can't audit them? So if you really want to get something accomplished, you could just do it through the Federal Reserve, too.
That's a great question, and I actually haven't thought of that before. But given, let's say, the extraordinary crisis we were in 2008 and the quid pro quos that can be involved in the movement of money, we'll buy $2 billion of your paper, China, if you do A, B, and C, or with Saudi Arabia or whomever. You should write a novel about that.
Well, I mean, you think about it.
I'd buy it.
Well, well.
If you gave me a footnote.
Yeah, well, yeah, and I'd have to do a lot of work figuring it out because I asked you the question, so it's black. But the point is if they're doing a lot of the international negotiations between countries and it's behind scenes, Congress doesn't know, then why wouldn't they justify doing big black budget things as well?
Well, I mean, their mandate is really pertains to the economy. And one of the things, at least we think that these Washingtonians are totally unchecked and unfettered. At least if you are working on the administrative side as opposed to the legislative side, as opposed to being in Congress, there are lots of laws that, if applied, can get you indicted and potentially in jail in a hurry. And I'll give you an example of one that most people probably never thought of, and this is my own back of the envelope thinking. But when George W. Bush first became president, Alan Greenspan stayed on as the Federal Reserve chair. And I think it was pretty clear that he agreed not to squawk with the large tax cuts as long as he got to designate the Treasury Secretary, who he picked was an old colleague of his named Paul O'Neill, who at the time was the CEO of Alcoa, the aluminum company in Pittsburgh. Yep. So Paul O'Neill, he's a successful CEO, had restructured Alcoa. They were then had good numbers, comes into Treasury, and like a lot of people who come into government positions from Wall Street or large companies, you know, and when you run a Wall Street firm or a Fortune 500 company, you're the CEO. It's what I call a democracy. One man or one woman and one vote. You know, the CEO has the vote and that's it.
Yep.
And you say jump and everybody says how high. Then you come to Washington and you find out that there's all kinds of landmines. There are all sorts of other appointed officials who know how to use the press better than you do and are willing to submarine you and make you look bad. And then you discover that there are these bureaucrats in the civil service who don't like your policies, and guess what? You can't fire them, and you can't order them around. If they don't like your policy.
It's a different world, yes.
Yeah, they'll say, we'll do it in June, but they won't say June of what year. So
they just drag their feet and make it
right,
a big
hassle
for you.
They wait them out. So Paul O'Neill goes through this, and he doesn't like the way the Bush White House works, and the Bush White House doesn't like dealing with him. And I can't remember if he lasted a year or a little over a year or whatever, and he leaves. And then he's kind of horrified by the lack of process with vetting, where, you know, you start with things as staff recommendations, and it goes up the ladder, and a number of people are looking at the pros and the cons, as opposed to policy emanating from the White House with less process and making a decision and going with it. And he just didn't like the way that worked, and he was, my guess is, shut out of a lot of major economic decisions. And he's saying, wait a minute, how can this happen? I'm supposed to be Secretary of the Treasury here. So he left, and then he started bad-mouthing the administration and the press, and he started going on all the talk shows and telling everybody how horrified he was with the way policy was determined in George W. Bush's first administration. And he said, you know what? He said, I'm 68 years old, I'm old, and I'm rich, and I'm going to tell it, as Howard Cosell would say, like it is. I'm going to tell the truth.
So what happened?
All of a sudden, Paul O'Neill stopped talking to the press and never made another public appearance. Now, here's my theory, and I think it's probably, I'll embellish it a little, but in large measure, truth. The administration did note that he left with 40 or 50 boxes of materials, and his purpose, of course, was to write his memoirs.
Yep.
But there are a number of complicated statutes that limit one's ability to remove federal documents from federal property, also that pertain to secrecy of documents that have not been declassified, etc. And I'd be willing to bet that something along the following lines occurred. That three FBI agents got into a car in Washington, pretty close to Pittsburgh, two and a half hours, took a little drive and had a little meeting with Paul O'Neill, reminded him of these various statutes that could apply in his situation, and read the statutes to him, which involved criminal penalties, and said something like, you know, it's not really that hard to get someone indicted under the federal system, particularly with all the things you took. And you know, you said you're old. We'll grant you that. You said you're rich. We'll grant you that. Do you want to spend the next 5 or 8 years of your life defending a criminal indictment? You could probably afford the $5 million to do it. But is that how you want to spend ages?
Yeah, they probably threatened
76?
Him. Yeah, they threatened
him.
Sure.
And you never heard from him again, ever again.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So it's a
well,
contact
but that's
sport.
How they do that, right? Yeah, it's a con. So let's get back into a couple more questions about taxes before this interview wraps up, because I have some.
And maybe, by the way, where we are right now and where we might go. The audience might be interested in.
Yeah, I want to ask you one question, because this has kind of been coming up lately with the presidential race, is the flat tax. What do you think about that?
Well, the flat tax in and of itself is fine.
But it gets rid of the loopholes and the credits, and it'll never happen.
Well, yes. Let me give a little historic perspective and then try to take it up to where we are right now. There actually was some very good fundamental tax reform in 1986. It was a little bit like what I called an eclipse of the sun. I never thought it was possible. But there was a grand compromise to lower rates, get rid of a lot of deductions, and as it's called in the tax world, flatten the base. Mm-hmm. Lower the rate, flatten the base, get rid of all these special interest things, and simplify. That compact pretty much was honored till about the early 1990s, and then between Clinton and the second Bush administration, it was Katie bar the door, and we've totally remucked the code up. So a couple of things that are on the table now. One is that for the average individual who is a wage earner, the tax code really isn't that complicated, and you also could raise the exempt level at which you don't have to pay taxes higher and take the average middle-class working person essentially off the income tax code. When you look at the sources of complexity, they're actually on opposite ends of the spectrum. The most complexity is with something called the earned income credit, which was a way to get money to the poor without calling it welfare, which is incredibly complicated, and where most of the auditing, believe it or not, occurs is at the lowest taxpayers who are actually getting tax refunds from the government and paying no tax, mm-hmm. that earned income credit, and at the opposite end, which is the big multinational corporations. Now, let me ask you a question. How much of the total money raised by income taxes in the United States, total tax revenue.
Yeah.
What percent, Sarah, would you guess is raised by the corporate income tax?
I would say not much. I would say the rate is higher than anywhere in the world, but I would think they figure out so many loopholes and so many things. The bigger corporations figure out how to get around it.
You're right. You're right. Less than 10% of the revenue of the U.S. government is raised by the corporate income tax. Incidentally, if you look at deficiencies in the system, tax cases where the IRS is trying to collect money, 70% is in one area alone of the corporate income tax.
Oh, go ahead. Say what it's called, and then I got.
It's called transfer pricing. In other words, it's how you price goods among related entities. Try to get the profit in a tax-exempt country.
Well, this is a point I wanted to make when it comes to corporations. The large companies, have lobbyists, and they figure out how to create the loopholes so they don't pay any taxes.
Absolutely right.
But what about the small companies? They're getting taxed through the nose.
Well, that's the problem. I mean, it's incredibly difficult to be in private business today between tax complexity now with the new healthcare system and the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, and those complexities, labor issues, consumer issues. You almost wonder how anyone can keep a small business going.
Well, because a small business, they really would be paying that 30, so I don't know what the rate is, 30%. They really will be paying that, whereas the large corporations who are their competitors are not. So their competitors are not only are they not paying taxes, they're getting the better rates from their suppliers. They have more money to spend on all the things that make them more competitive. Of course, they don't have the nimble, you know, the flexibility that a small company has. So that's probably their only benefit, is the fact that they can create a culture and they can be a lot more dynamic and, you know, things that large companies struggle with. But that's why the large companies are just buying them out, because the small companies just can't compete once they get to a certain size.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right. You're right. So I think tax legislation for this year is effectively dead. We're too close to a presidential election. One of the things that is being talked about more is eventually a national sales tax, a value-added tax, which...
Oh, geez. Just added to the list. And that's because of the internet, though, right? Is to make that whole thing...
No.
It's not?
You could just do that. No, you could just subject internet sales to state sales tax.
Which is what they're
doing. Well, there have been bills introduced to do that. I assume that eventually will happen.
That happens at the state level, right?
Yes. No, the federal government has to pass a law that...
No, I'm sorry.
You're right. No, it is a state level. Yeah,
yes.
Different states have done it differently. Which
makes it a nightmare for the internet companies that sell across all states.
Yeah, but they're pretty smart technology people. I think they can figure it out. The bigger question, I think, looming is this. At some point, does the world stop taking our paper and say, hey, you know, the U.S. is over-leveraged, you're going to have to get your fiscal house in order and raise some money. And the only way, I mean, if you really sort of were simply designing a system with no political consequences, a big caveat, because obviously few things are as sensitive, or maybe nothing's as sensitive as tax policy. But you could say, okay, the corporate income tax, 90% of the complexity, raises less than 10% of the revenue. Let's get rid of it, and it's a more efficient system anyway. It'd be a more efficient economic system without it anyway.
But don't you think there needs to be a complete disaster before they're going to do anything significant?
You've taken my punchline. There has to be some type of a fiscal disaster where that occurs, and then someone says, okay, the only way we can really raise a lot of revenue and replace the tax is with a value-added tax or national consumption tax, the way European countries have, and then we'll be...
Now the situation is ripe where we can do something major.
And we have health care, as I sometimes say. We have European socialism, but we don't have the good food. This isn't fair.
Yeah, well, you know, when people always point to the Weimar Republic, the Germany, and they talk about how their money system collapsed, but what they don't understand is that after World War I, the different countries enforced a huge debt payback that they had to pay to all the – a fine, essentially, that Germany had something like 3.2 – a significant – 250 trillion or something. I don't remember the number, but it was so massive that they figured that it would take them 50 to 75 years to even pay it off if they just dedicated themselves to it. So in order to pay it off, they had to do hyperinflation, right? They hyperinflated themselves out of this debt. That was their only option. And then they started over, and it collapsed their economy, and they started over. It created all sorts of issues, but it solved their problem and they could start over and move on. What would keep the United States from not just orchestrating a complete collapse so they could start over?
Well, we do have a democracy, and collapses are, are not, as they say in the mafia, good for business.
But once you get to a certain point, in Germany, it got to such a painful point that was their only option.
Well, you know, as you look at political strategies, et cetera, sometimes people do speculate that some people who are in positions of power are trying to create a code that falls of its own weight. And that brings us to another issue we haven't touched on, and as worthy of a whole another hour.
Well, it does. And maybe we can look at that.
But let me say this, and that's the whole IRS and the administrative apparatus. The problems, Nina Olson, the taxpayer advocate who's designed to be the interface between the taxpaying community and the IRS, she was in town for a seminar at the University of Minnesota Law School on Friday and just did a terrific job of going through all sorts of issues and problems that the IRS has. But Congress is starving the IRS administratively, which, number one, gets people upset with it. They can now only answer a third of their calls.
Oh, yes. Makes people angry.
And 2 years ago, it was as high as 75%. So you create the anger at the IRS, and you come into Congress, and you say, get rid of them, cut it back. So there's some of that going on. Plus, it's just bad business because you're starving the audit process. And, you know, for every auditor you hire, you'll get back 10 to 1 in revenue if you're hiring the right people. So we are doing a tremendous disservice to the tax process, tax system in this country by starving the IRS. And I think that the policy or the thought of starving the IRS to have it fall of its own weight, it's not good for the country. There are serious legitimate issues that need to be dealt with on the tax front, both administrative and from a policy standpoint, but don't cut off your nose to spite your face.
Yeah.
And that's what we're doing right now.
Well, MIT did a study, and they say that in 2032, just based on the mathematical equations of our country, that it'll collapse.
Yes, that will be precisely 6 months after my life expectancy has expired. So,
so you
that's
okay
not
here?
At the top of my agenda right now. But if you come in with a report that says 27, 28, somewhere in that time frame, it'll get a little more of my attention.
That's okay. Oh, that's funny. Okay, well, let's end on a really positive note for listeners. What can people do to save money when it comes to taxes? What are the best ways to reduce the amount of taxes that they pay?
Well, I'll tell you what my boss told me when I went to work for the government the first time. He said, you now have the world's best tax shelter, a government job. Make less money. the short answer is the ability to legitimately shelter money for individuals is very limited. And, you know, you have the home interest mortgage, you have the charitable deduction, but the screws are really on quite tight now, so...
Well, you can look for the different tax credits, correct? I mean, take advantage of the tax credits when you can.
Yes.
So, like the solar tax credit that's expiring in 2015 is a great tax credit.
And I think hiring the most competent, highest-priced tax lawyers, such as myself, whose fees are deductible, provide
exactly.
instant deductions for people who want to pay fees. In certain select situations, I'm open to that as well.
That seems like the best way to do it.
I'm with you.
Okay. Well, that's great. Now, how can people seriously reach you if they, want to book you for a speaking engagement or if they want to get tax advice or your legal services?
I'll give you my email, which is ajwilensky@AOL.com, or my phone is 612-843-2393, 612-843-2393, or my 800 number, 1-800-NO-TAXES.
That was
actually a joke, but.
It's not your real 1-800 number.
No.
That's probably taken up by somebody for sure.
By the way, what the IRS used to always say when they'd leave the phone number you could call in on regulations that were published.
Yeah.
They always used to say not a toll-free call. But we'll pay tolls. We'll take collect calls.
Okay. Well, we'll have that information on the radio page as well, and we'll have it up for the listeners to reach you. And thanks for talking. This is always entertaining.
Thank you, Sarah.
Okay. Have a great day.
You too. Bye.
Well, that was an interesting conversation about taxes, and Alan has this way of making taxes interesting, which is hard to do, so he's a pretty talented guy. So for now, everyone have a wonderful day.